And it was very, very clear, I would say, almost every edit they made to the piece, that was the aim.
And we changed this and this and this, and then that wasn't good enough. Okay, now change this and this and this. Now change this and this. Version after version after version, 83 times.
83 times is unheard of. It doesn't happen. You shouldn't have to rewrite something 83 times. Obviously, they didn't want to put the thing on the air, and they were trying to drive us crazy and get us to quit or wait until the first window in our contract so that they could fire us.
They, in effect, announced that they were going to fire us for no cause. Well, this was a little much.
And Steve wrote a letter to the lawyer in Atlanta, whose name is Carolyn Forrest, the Fox corporate lawyer.
And I said, you know, this isn't about being fired for no cause. You're firing us because we refused to put on the air something that we knew and demonstrated to be false and misleading. That's what this is about. And because we put up a fight, because we stood up to this big corporation, and we stood up to your editors, and we stood up to your lawyers, and we said to you, look, there ought to be a principle higher than just making money.
And she wrote a letter back and said, you're right, that's exactly what it was. You stood up to us on this story, and that's why we're letting you go. Big mistake. Big mistake. That says retaliation. You can't retaliate against employees if they're standing up for something that they believe is illegal, that they don't want to participate in. So that gave us the whistleblower status that we needed in the state of Florida to file a whistleblower claim against our employer.
And as far as our two or three years later, we got to trial. 5 weeks of testimony led to a jury verdict of $425,000, in which the jury determined that the story they pressured us to broadcast, the story we resisted telling, was in fact false, distorted, or slant.
Fox News appealed the verdict. Five major news media corporations filed briefs with the court in support of Fox's appeal.
3 years later.
Florida's appellate court has ruled in favor of Fox 13. You may recall that Jane Akre, a former reporter here, sued Fox 13 in a whistleblower lawsuit, claiming she was fired for refusing to distort her report. The appeals court today threw that case out, saying Ms. Akre had no whistleblower claim against the station based on news distortion. Fox 13 Vice President and General Manager Bob Linger says the station has been completely vindicated by the ruling.
What Fox neglected to report is this. Jane sued Fox under Florida's whistleblower statute, which protects those who try to prevent others from breaking the law. But her appeal court judges found that falsifying news isn't actually against the law. So they denied Jane her whistleblower status, overturned the case, and withdrew her $425,000 award. Canada and Europe have upheld the ban on RBGH, yet it remains hidden in much of the milk supply of the United States. In the concluding hour of the corporation, we raise troubling questions about the corporation's history of indifference to democracy, and we'll look at the high-stakes contest between grassroots activists and global corporations to decide who or what will shape our future.
You have been listening to part two of The Corporation, a three-part documentary directed by Mark Akbar and Jennifer Abbott and written by Joel Bakken based on his book, The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power. Next week, Part 3. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
What will you do there, says Miller to Munger? Do you swear to tell no one, says Johnson to Judd? We'll break the machinery, improve the scenery, meet in the greenery after, says Ludd. And how will you break 'em, says Miller to Munger? Stick with us, we'll show you, says Johnson to Judd. With pikes and with hammers, with fire and spanners, to teach 'em some manners, says General Ludd. Die, die, die-de-dum, die-de-dum, die. Cause and if we don't break 'em, our lives they will take 'em. Our craft, our cottage, our village as well. No freedom or laughter for those who come after, but a servant and master in a factory hell. So the door was kicked in, and the frames were all broken, and the owner was woken and raised the alarm, and the yeoman came riding, but we were in hiding, the people providing to keep us from harm. From Notts up to Lancashire, Yorkshire to Derbyshire, 1811 to 1813, Lad's army enlisted and the people resisted. The march of the more money-making machine. Die, die, die-de-dum, die-de-dum, die. How now shall we stop it, says owner to roller, with spies and with soldiers, says Tory to Whig. We'll hang every breaker and Luddite, oath taker, transport troublemakers. And that's what they did. 14 hung on a beam, ugliest justice that you've ever seen. 50 in all who took a long fall in the rising against the machine. Slavery, hungered and homeless, and bowed to the boss whose factories killed them and crippled their children, and all for the worship of profit and law. Some call it futility, they say the future will be what the engine of progress demands. But luck called humanity back to reality. We weave our destiny with our own hands. All hands that are ready to hold a line steady, to pull down the fences or pull up a crop, unlock the laboratory, build a home in the treetop, till the driving and never arriving has stopped. Stop! And some call us vandals, and some call us hooligans, and some call us Luddites, and some rent a mob. But we're standing up proud and we're shouting out loud, for the sake of our family, let's finish this job. And when the job's done, and the long wars are over, and we've all recovered the love in our blood, our ancestors' voices will join our rejoicing, and sing to the memory of General Ludd, and we'll sing to the memory of General Ludd, and we sing to the memory of General Ludd. Die, 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 de dum, die, de dum, die.
On January 26th, Walmart opened its doors in Ithaca after an intermittent, decade-long struggle by many in the community to keep it out. Walmart is the world's largest retailer and has reached its preeminent position by providing low prices and convenience. But this has been achieved by a host of externalities that negatively affect the condition of working people here and abroad. Walmart is a major mover in the outsourcing of jobs to overseas sweatshops through the so-called free trade regimen. At home, it has led to a race to the bottom in wages and benefits for American retail workers, and it is so aggressively anti-union that it has closed a meatpacking department in a Texas store and now an entire facility in Jonquière, Quebec, which succeeded in unionizing. But this strategy can only get it so far. It needs to keep its stores open if it wants to do business. The Tompkins County Living Wage Coalition, a group of community activists dedicated to livable wages for all workers, whether unionized or not, began a groundbreaking campaign to insist that if Walmart wants to operate in Ithaca, it must pay a living wage. Pete Myers, organizer with the Tompkins County Living Wage Coalition.
We started our campaign in like November, and Walmart actually took out 5 days of half-page ads in the Ithaca Journal, essentially responding to our campaign and saying that their average wage for employees is $9.90 an hour, which was so disingenuous because, you know, that's including all levels of employees. And to say, you know, I bet a person making $6.50 an hour at Walmart would be kind of flabbergasted to find that the average wage was $9.90 an hour. I mean, how is that helping them at $6.50? Important thing to know, though, is there's a lot of people, low-income people, for example, that want Walmart to be here. We've got to figure out a way to reach those people. You know, and it's not going to work for us just to see Walmart as evil incarnate or to project that image that we see them that way. You know, we've got to reach out to Walmart shoppers, and that's, you know, we're cultivating our message. We weren't out there in protest. You know, our present action, in addition to negotiating with Walmart, with some city, county leaders and religious leaders and union leaders, we're also getting people to sign petitions telling Walmart that this is a living wage community. At present, we define a living wage in Tompkins County to be $8.44 an hour, presuming full health insurance coverage. This is defined by Alternatives Federal Credit Union, which is probably unusual. Not many banks or credit unions do a living wage study, and so they do update this every couple of years, and it's now $8.44 an hour. It would probably be closer to $10 an hour if health insurance wasn't being paid for. And so basically that's one of the principles that the Living Wage Coalition takes up, that a person should be paid adequately in this society, in a society of plenty and wealth such as ours. They should be paid enough to be self-sufficient. And as we know, so many people are not.
What Walmart is doing as part of a larger political movement, but also very directly in terms of its own structure, its own organization, its own policies, it is battling what remains of New Deal America.
Labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein, who studies the social effects of Walmart.
The fights that are taking place now in California and Chicago and maybe New York State really is because this corporation, as it moves into these areas which have had the strongest representation of, we think of New Deal regulation of corporate power, New Deal, post-New Deal, Great Society, wage and benefit levels, the battles that have been sparked as a result of that are this contest that's taking place. Yes, there is a transformation taking place in the world economy, but it does not have to be beyond our reach to have something to say about it and how it will be structured.
It appears that we're the only living wage campaign that's taken Walmart on. So we're kind of on the cutting edge. Many communities fight Walmart before they come in, but not many communities fight them once they're there. So, unless it's like a union campaign, but there's no successful unions. There's been no successful union struggle in terms of a union actually being able to unionize in a Walmart to this point.
It's not that unions haven't been trying and that the workers don't want unions. Brian Neath, an organizer with the Canadian Food and Commercial Workers Union.
They have a system where their head office in Benton, Arkansas, every store is hooked up by a computer. And when anybody from the union, and we are all relatively identified, walks into a store, immediately at their head office, they will contact the store and say, we know that Brian Neath has walked in the store, and we know that he's from USCW, get him out of the store immediately. What they do, one of the biggest things that they do, is immediately they find out that the union is around and that people are interested in joining a union, they immediately say to the workers that we are going to close your store. And obviously that puts fear into the workers that they're going to end up losing their job. They also isolate union supporters. In the United States, again, it's harder to do this in Canada, but in the United States, they move union supporters to a different store just before the vote. They make sure that they move anti-union employees into the store before the vote so that they have the effect of making sure that it's the store is unionized, not unionized when it comes to a vote. They also have a policy more so in the United States and Canada, again, is that when you apply for the job, they directly ask you if you are a union supporter, and if you were to say that you were, you would never get a job at Walmart. You are not allowed to talk to anybody in any other department in Walmart because they're concerned that people could talk about union within the department. It is actually a principle of Walmart to be non-union. As an example, Walmart has a team, an anti-union team, that when they hear that the union is around, they will send that team in, and those people will coach all the employees, talk to them. They call it coaching, but really it's just telling them all the things that they believe are wrong about the union and why they shouldn't be unionized.
So how does the Tompkins County Living Wage Coalition hope to succeed? Pete Myers.
Our strategy to this point initially has been to attempt to open up a dialogue with Walmart out of the thinking that they were probably going to be more likely to want to dialogue or have a negotiation, partially because of the stigma that's been attached to Walmart in the past few years because of law cases coming at them. So we've actually opened up a dialogue and we've engaged the mayor of the city of Ithaca, Carolyn Peterson, Tim Joseph, the chair of the county legislature, a couple, like 27 religious leaders. So we had an initial meeting about 3 weeks ago, and it's kind of like a fact-finding mission at this point. So we were able to find out that we were surprised that they told us that they're starting people at $6.50 an hour. I think we actually thought they'd probably start people more higher than that, but they're starting people at $6.50 an hour. And the minimum wage, as many people know, has just been risen to $6 an hour in the state of New York. Part of the point of our campaign, why are we not targeting a small business in Tompkins County or Ithaca? Well, the reason for that is we believe everybody should pay a living wage, but a company especially as profitable as Walmart, easily one of the most profitable companies in this country with a $9 billion a year profit after taxes and everything, they can afford to do better.
Walmart is saying that they're creating great benefits in Ithaca, and they've been taking out advertisements. They say that they're going to provide 355 new jobs, and that's going to cut down on the people. They say there are 600 unemployed people in Ithaca and 1,800 in Tompkins County. Currently, they're going to pay $314,000 in local real estate taxes, millions of dollars in sales tax revenue that will be paid to the state, the county, and the city.
Well, the other side of that, though, is for people that they're employing at just barely above the minimum wage, we then, those people, especially if they have children, are going to be eligible for social service benefits. So while they're paying us local real estate taxes, we're going to be paying for people to be, we're subsidizing Walmart and their low wages that they pay, because these people will be able to apply at a Department of Social Services for benefits, such as food stamps, public, cash benefits, child care benefits. So, while they're paying us on one end, we're having to pay for it on the other end. So it's really like not a net gain, I don't believe. So if Walmart paid a living wage, then, the taxpayers would be off the hook, So we really are subsidizing Walmart's low wages. We really are. I mean, that's a point that we really need to drive home. Now, it's true that, Joe's Diner, State Street Diner, if they're paying $6.50 an hour, we're subsidizing them as well. A little bit different. I mean, it's a little bit different thing in my mind when they're probably just barely making ends meet compared to Walmart, which is making $9 billion a year. Another one that's interesting is the millions of dollars sales tax revenue will be paid. I mean, they're basically just collecting that. I mean, we have a Peace and Justice gift shop up here. We have to pay sales tax. I mean, for them to say, all they're saying is we're collecting it from people. I mean, if you go to Walmart and buy something, you're the one paying the sales tax. It's not Walmart that's paying the sales tax. So to even put that in just seems kind of dubious. Although the other side of it, playing the devil's advocate, is to my own point, is that, I do know people that would go to Cortland or Watkins Glen to go to Walmart. So that was taking those tax dollars outside of Ithaca, So, and the fact that it's in the city, as opposed to being at the mall or in Lansing, for example, that means the city gets tax dollars and it's not going to Lansing. So that's the other side of it.
Okay. Has anyone calculated what the net gain for the city of Ithaca itself might be as a result of this? Does anyone have any way of knowing that?
I think that they're calculating, the city is calculating $400,000 gain. But again, that would be up against the fact that these are people that are also going to be eligible for social service benefits. So that doesn't get calculated in. But that would come from a different pot of money. It wouldn't come from the city. But it would all come from us. But it wouldn't come directly from the city budget.
They say that two-thirds of Walmart associates are senior citizens, college students, or second-income providers. How does that statement strike you? What does that mean?
They're basically saying that these people don't need any more than what they're making. So the first one that stood out to me was the second-income providers. So, you know, imagine this. These are, like, generally speaking, lower-income people. So I'm imagining, like, basically they're saying to women who work at Walmart that, oh, you're just a second income provider. So, you know, that's insulting to me that they would say, oh, these people don't need a living wage. Like, why? I mean, I'm dubious about the two-thirds being senior citizens, college students, or second income providers. I don't believe that all college students are rich either. I mean, you know, at all. And senior citizens, my goodness. I imagine when I'm a senior citizen, you know, I'm not going to be having a lot of money coming from Social Security, if I have any at all. So I'm going to need a job that's going to pay a living wage. Almost on the heels of that came, I don't know if you heard about this, a national Walmart campaign basically starting to say the same thing about how, and there was different points to it, how Walmart is helping communities and it's giving people benefits and it's providing jobs. It's a national campaign, and this was reported on nationally, and it was also advertisements taken out in major newspapers. And it actually appeared here in Ithaca, those same advertisements, before it appeared anywhere else.
Walmart is trying to polish its image in the wake of damaging revelations. Last August, the University of California's Center for Labor Research and Education released a study that concluded, quote, "Reliance by Walmart workers on public assistance programs in California comes at a cost to the taxpayers of an estimated $86 million annually." The report said families of Walmart employees in California use about 40% more in taxpayer-funded health care than the average for large retail employees, and that Walmart families use an estimated 38% more in other non-health care public assistance programs such as food stamps, subsidized school lunches, and subsidized housing. The study estimates that Walmart workers in California earn on average 31% less than workers employed in large retail businesses as a whole. Large retail was defined by the study as companies with more than 1,000 employees. And Walmart is the target of several legal actions because of their labor practices. Pete Myers.
Well, around the country, I mean, there's like a class action lawsuit. One of them has to do with women being able to advance. I mean, there's 1.5 million women who have worked at Walmart who have signed on to this class action lawsuit. I mean, that's no small potatoes. And basically saying that they didn't have an adequate chance to advance at Walmart. Basically claiming gender discrimination. And that case is going forward in courts. Other cases, other class action things talk about Walmart making people work more than 40 hours off the clock. Basically, so that'd be an overtime case, inadequate pay for overtime hours. Also locking people, you know, people coming in from other, they would hire like custodial services in various places around the country, and basically locking these custodial service employees in the store after hours.
Walmart's explanation was that the workers were locked in for their own safety. But some Walmart workers have charged in lawsuits that they were locked in at the end of their work days to force them to work overtime restocking shelves without being paid.
And it's just so big, and it helps to set, on different levels, I mean, it's helping to set sweatshop wages around the world, but it's also helping to set wages in our own country. You know, it's like a Walmart moves into a, you know, a place like Ithaca, and that's part of the concern, I think, that why people wanted to stop it here. You had asked earlier about why were people fighting it here. And, you know, I mean, they claim that they're going to add 350 new jobs, but how many businesses are going to go out of business as a result of Walmart coming? What will the net gain of jobs be? That's yet to be seen.
It is setting the social standards, the industrial policy for the United States. It sets the real minimum wage in many parts of the country, establishes the health care system by its competition with other firms who have better health care benefits, and they seek to bring them down to the Walmart level. It's so big that it's setting the standards for the way other corporations function, and that's been referred to by lots of people, the Walmartization of work, of corporations, etc. It is the largest corporation in terms of both number of workers and in terms of sales in the world. It is huge. It has $300 billion in sales. The Economist and other journals estimate they'll have $1 trillion in sales in a decade. So it's gigantic. It employs 1.4 million around the world. It's the biggest private employer in the U.S., in Canada, and in Mexico. It imports more from China than either the United Kingdom or Russia. It's not just big, of course. Walmart now really sets the standards, really legislates. If you want to know where social legislation is taking place in America today, you go to Bentonville.
So I think Walmart has been successful on a national level of presenting itself as being the store with the cheapest prices. Always, their slogan is always low prices. So, I mean, I think that's, you know, through advertisements and through, you know, we do need to do a study at some point, I think, to actually do some kind of, you know, it'd be quite a thorough thing and it'd be time intensive, but, you know, actually comparing its prices to other places. But that perception is out there, though, that Walmart has cheaper prices. And for a lot of people, in addition to that, I think we don't have a super center here, but many people can go to Walmart, they think, and shop for everything that they need in that one location. Now, a supercenter would basically mean food in addition. This Walmart here does have food, but not, it's not like a full grocery store. A supercenter would be a full grocery store. Walmart has been successful in its marketing, you know, and we're having to combat that, basically, and figure out how to market ourselves.
Walmart came out of Arkansas at a time, really northwestern Arkansas, when it was founded, its labor policies, its whole culture was based upon a kind of part of the South before the civil rights movement, before the feminist movement, really before the regulatory reforms of the New Deal were put in place. And Walmart was smart in not moving its second generation of stores to, you know, Seattle or New York or San Francisco. It spread like molasses through tier after tier of rural counties, which meant that Walmart was able to maintain the Southern patriarchal culture as it went along, had a very, very vigorous and self-contained managerial culture, which now, again, we're sort of confronting as it moves now, finally, into California or Illinois or New York. What is to be done, as it were? What is to be done? I think the coalitions are forming and conducting political fights against Walmart. Inglewood rejected a referendum which would have put a Walmart supercenter in downtown Inglewood as a result, because Walmart was trying to move around the city council. It was a kind of a very arrogant, undemocratic effort to get the zoning law changed. People have many different motives for opposing Walmart. Some don't like its aesthetics. Some think it'll ruin Main Street business. Others don't like its social policies, its labor policies, etc. Whatever the reason, I think these coalitions have and will be and are being encouraged by the labor movement, which I think will be the backbone of that. And I think the goal of this political mobilization against Walmart is to say, we welcome you into our community if you're willing to pay wages which will afford a decent living, if you're willing to pay health benefits which are not exorbitant to your workers, and if you don't deprive taxpayers through the back door of money for your workers because they can't earn enough, but you're paying them, they have to go to welfare and they have to go to various social services. If we can change the business model of Walmart, then I think that will be a first success for these coalitions.
You know, unions are really struggling with the question now of how to go forward, and I've never personally been unionized myself. So I think that one of the things that unions are realizing is that they need to be more community-based than they have been. So I think where we could be successful, where unions haven't been successful, is that we intend this to be a whole union campaign. If a union came in and tried to organize the Walmart here on their own without community support, their only hope is to get people who work at Walmart who are going to be really scared that they're going to get fired. I mean, and we would welcome a union effort here, no doubt. But if we have a whole community campaign going on at the same time, I mean, that's going to be more scary to Walmart than any union organizing effort, because they can scare workers, basically. But they're not going to be, you know, I've they're not going to scare me.
Pete Myers of the Tompkins County Living Wage Coalition will continue to follow this story as it progresses. Thanks to Ken Nash, Mimi Rosenberg, and Stuart Duncan for their contributions to the preceding report. And now we'll conclude the program as we continue with Mark Twain's saga of a rebellious angel's exploration of human moral values.
My name is Scooter, and you're listening to The Inner Side, produced at KPFT Houston for Free Radio Santa Cruz, LPFM, and community radio stations worldwide. We're going to continue with our radio adaptation of Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger. Recapping our story up to this point, Satan, having been ejected from heaven for not towing the party line, is spending some quality exile time on planet Earth. We pick him up in 15th century Austria, hanging out in the woods with some young lads from a nearby village. He's been wowing the boys by molding a miniature castle full of tiny people from clay. And then he created a giant storm and earthquake that swallowed the entire creation and all perished.
Not one of the 500 poor creatures escaping. Our hearts were broken.
This had a rather unsettling effect on the youngsters. But they've all gone to hell, I cried. Oh, it's no matter. We can make plenty more, Satan replied. It was of no use to try and move him. Evidently, he was wholly without feeling and couldn't understand. He was full of bubbling spirits, as if this were a wedding instead of a fiendish massacre. He was bent on making us feel the same, and of course, his magic accomplished just that. In a little while, we were dancing on that grave, and he was playing to us on a strange, sweet instrument which he took from his pocket, and the music. There's no music like that. The bliss of paradise was in it. Presently, he said he must go away on an errand. We pleaded with him to stay. That pleased him, and he said he would sit down and talk for a few minutes more. He told us his real name was to be known by us alone, but in the presence of others, he was to be called Philip Traum. It sounded so ordinary for such a being. We had seen the wonders of this day, and it would be such a pleasure to tell them when I got home. But he noticed these thoughts and said, "All of these matters are to remain among us four. You may try to tell them if you want, but I'll protect your tongue so nothing of our secrets will escape." Well, that cost us a sigh or two. We talked pleasantly along, and he was always reading our thoughts and responding to them. And it seemed to me that this was the most wonderful of all things he did. But he interrupted my musings and said, "No, it will be wonderful for you, but it is not wonderful for me. I'm not limited like you, nor subject to human conditions. I can measure your human weaknesses, and I study them, but I have none. My flesh is not real. My clothes are not real. I'm a spirit." "Father Peter's coming." We looked around but didn't see anyone. "He's not in sight yet, but you'll see him presently." "Do you know him, Satan?" "No." "Won't you talk with him when he comes? He's not dull like us, will you?" "Perhaps later." There he is now. Father Peter approached through the chestnuts. We three were sitting together in the grass and Satan sat in the path. Father Peter came slowly along, stopping to mop his face with a handkerchief. Presently he muttered, "I can't think what brought me here. It seems as if I were in my study a minute ago. I suppose I've been dreaming along and come all this way without noticing. I'm not myself these troubled days." He went mumbling along to himself and walked straight through Satan, just as if nothing were there. It made us catch our breath and cry out, but something mysteriously restrained us. Father Peter disappeared into the trees. Satan spoke, "As I told you, I'm only a spirit." "We're not spirits," said Nicholas. "He looked right through us." "I wished it so," replied Satan. It seemed almost too good to be true that we were actually seeing these romantic and wonderful things. And there he sat, looking just like anybody, natural and simple and charming and chatting along again, same as ever. And, well, words cannot describe what we felt. He was back in the old ages once more now and making them live before us. He had seen so much. It was just a wonder to look at him. But it made you seem so trivial and the creature of a day, so temporary. And he said nothing to raise up your dropping pride, not a word. He always spoke of men with indifference, as one speaks of bricks and manure piles and such things. You could see that they were of no consequence to him. He didn't mean to hurt us. You could see that. Just as we don't mean to insult a brick when we disparage it. A brick's emotions are nothing to us. He bunched kings and conquerors, poets, prophets, pirates, and beggars together. Just a brick pile. I was shamed into putting in a word for man and asked him why he had so much difference between men and himself. He had to struggle with that for a moment. He didn't seem to understand how I could ask such a strange question. And then he said, "The difference between man and me? The difference between a mortal and an immortal? Between a cloud and a spirit?" He picked up a beetle that was creeping along a piece of bark. "What's the difference between Caesar and this?" "One cannot compare things whose natures are so different," I replied. "You've answered your own question," he said. "Man is made of dirt. I saw him made. I'm not made of dirt. Man is a museum of diseases, a home of impurities. He comes today, he is gone tomorrow. He begins as dirt and departs as stench. I am of the aristocracy of the imperishables. And man has the moral sense. You understand? He has moral values. That would seem to be difference enough between us, all by itself." He stopped there, as if that settled the matter. At the time, I had but a dim idea of what moral values were. I merely knew that we were proud of having them, and when he talked like that, it wounded me. I felt as a girl feels, who thinks her dearest finery is being admired and then overhears strangers making fun of it. For a while, we were all silent. Then Satan began to chat again, and soon he was sparkling along, putting us in a gale of laughter. He told us of the time Samson tied torches to the foxes' tails and set them loose in the Philistines' corn, and Samson, sitting on the fence, slapping his thighs and laughing, with tears running down his cheeks, and lost his balance and fell off the fence. The memory of that picture got him laughing, too, and we did have a most lovely and jolly time. By and by, he said, "I'm going to go on my errand now." "Don't," we all said, "you won't come back." "Yes, I will. It won't be long. I'll give you my word." "We like you." "And I like you," he replied. "As proof, I'll show you something fine to see. Usually when I go, I just vanish. For you, I'll dissolve myself." He stood up and thinned away, and thinned away until he was a soap bubble, except that he kept his shape. All over him played delicate, iridescent colors. He floated, bounced a few times, then burst. It was a strange and beautiful thing to see. We didn't say anything, but we sat wondering and blinking. Finally, Seppi rose up and sighed. "I suppose none of it happened, huh?" Nicholas agreed. I had the same cold fear in my mind. Then we saw old Father Peter wandering along back with his head bent down, searching the ground. When he was close, he looked up. "How long have you been here, boys?" "A little while, Father. Maybe you can help me. Did you come up by the path?" "Yes, Father." "Good," he went on. "I lost my wallet. Not much in it, but a little is a lot to me. It's all I had. I suppose you haven't seen it." "No, Father, but we'll help you search." "Well, thank you, but why, here it is." We hadn't noticed it, yet there it lie, right where Satan stood when he began to melt, if it wasn't a delusion. Father Peter picked it up and looked very much surprised. "It is mine," he said, "but not the contents. This is heavy." He opened it up, and it was stuffed as full as it could be with gold coins. He let us gaze our fill, which we did. We had never seen so much money. All our mouths came open to say, "Satan did it," but nothing came out. There it was, you see. We couldn't tell what he didn't want told. He had said so himself. "Boys, did you do this?" It made us laugh, and made him laugh, too, as soon as he thought what a foolish question it was. "Who has been here?" he asked. Our mouths came open to answer, but stood so for a moment. "Not a human being," I spoke up, for I didn't want to lie and condemn my immortal soul. "That's so," said the others, and let their mouths go shut. "Impossible," said Father Peter, and looked at us very severely. "Someone has been here since I passed. I don't mean to say you saw him, but someone did pass, that I know. On your honor, you saw no one?" "Not a human being." He began to count the money, and we eagerly helped to stack the piles. "It's 1,100 ducats odd," he said. "Oh, dear, if it were only mine. I need it so," and his voice broke and lips quivered. "It is yours," we all cried out at once. "Every heller." "No, it isn't mine. Only 4 ducats are mine. The rest," he fell to dreaming, poor old soul, caressing the coins in his hands, he forgot where he was, sitting there on his heels, It was pitiful to see. No, he said, waking up. It isn't mine. I can't account for it. It must be a trap. Nicholas said, Father Peter, with the exception of the astrologer, you haven't a real enemy in the village, nor Margaret either. And not even a half enemy that's rich enough to chance 1,100 ducats to do you a mean turn. He couldn't get around that argument, and it cheered him up. But it isn't mine, you see. It isn't mine. In any case, he said it in a wistful way, like a person that wouldn't be sorry if anybody would contradict him. If I only had 100 of it, he went on. The house is to be foreclosed tomorrow. It is yours, Father Peter, and we are witness to it, aren't we, boys? We two said yes, and Nicholas stuffed the money back into the shabby old wallet and made the owner take it. So he said he would use 200 of it for his house, and we'll put the rest at interest till the rightful owner came for it. And on our side, we must sign a paper showing how he got the money, as proof that it was not ill-gotten. It made immense talk the next day when Father Peter paid Solomon Isaacs in gold and left the rest of the money with him at interest. Also, there was a pleasant change. Many people called at the house to congratulate him, and a number of cool old friends became kind and friendly again. And to top all, Margaret was invited to a party. And there was no mystery. Father Peter told the whole circumstance just as it happened, and said he could not account for it, only it was the plain hand of Providence, so far as he could see. One or two shook their heads and said privately, it looked more like the hand of Satan. A surprisingly good guess for ignorant people like that. Some came slyly buzzing around and tried to coax us boys to come out and tell the truth, and promised they'd never tell, but only wanted to know for their own satisfaction, the whole thing being so curious. They even wanted to buy the secret and pay money for it, and if we could have invented something that would answer, but we couldn't. We had the ingenuity, so we had to let the chance go by. It was a pity. We carried that secret around without any trouble. But the other one, the big one, the splendid one, burned the very vitals of us. It was so hot to get out, and we so hot to let it out and astonish people with it. But we had to keep it in. In fact, it kept itself in. Satan said it would, and it did. We went off every day to the woods so that we could talk about it. It really was the only subject we thought of or cared about. Day and night we watched for him and hoped he would come, and we got more and more impatient all the time. We hadn't any interest in the other boys anymore. It wouldn't take part in their games and enterprises. They seemed so tame after Satan, and their doings so trifling and commonplace after his adventures in antiquity and constellations and his miracles and meltings and explosions and all that. During that first day, we were in a constant state of anxiety on account of one thing, and we kept going to Father Peter's house on one pretext or another to keep track of it. That was the gold coins. We were afraid it would crumble and turn to dust, like fairy money, but it didn't. At the end of the day, no complaint was made about it, so after that, we were satisfied that it was real gold and dropped the anxiety from our minds. There was a question which we wanted to ask Father Peter. And finally we went there on the second evening a little diffidently after drawing straws, and I asked it as casually as I could, though it did not sound as casual as I wanted, because I didn't know how. What are moral values, sir? The moral sense? He looked down, surprised, over his great spectacles, and said, Why, it's the faculty which enables us to distinguish good from evil. It threw some light, but not a glare, and I was a little disappointed, also to some degree embarrassed. He was waiting for me to go on, and in default of anything else to say, I asked, Is it valuable? Valuable? Heavens, lad, it is the one thing that lifts man above the beasts that perish and makes him heir to immortality. Now, this did not remind me of anything further to say, so I got out with the other boys, and we went away with an indefinite sense you have of being filled but not fattened. They wanted me to explain, but I was tired. We passed out through the parlor, and there was Margaret on the spinet teaching Marie Luger. So one of the deserting pupils was back, and an influential one, too. The others would follow. Margaret jumped up and thanked us again with tears in her eyes for saving her and her uncle from being turned into the streets. And we told her again we hadn't done it, but that was her way. She never could be grateful enough for anything a person did for her. So we let her have her say. And as we passed through the garden, there was Wilhelm Meidling, sitting there waiting. For it was getting toward the edge of the evening, and he would be asking Margaret to take a walk along the river with him when she was done with the lesson. He was a young lawyer and succeeding fairly well and working his way along, little by little. He was very fond of Margaret and she of him. He had not deserted along with the others, but had stood his ground all through. His faithfulness was not lost on Margaret and her uncle. He hadn't much talent, but he was handsome and good, and these are kind of talents. He asked us how the lesson was getting along, and we told him it was about done. And maybe it was so. We didn't know anything about it, but we judged it would please him, and it did. It didn't cost us anything. On the fourth day comes the astrologer from his crumbling old tower up the valley, where he had heard the news, I reckon. He had a private talk with us. We told him what we could, for we were mightily in dread of him. He sat there studying and studying a while to himself. Then he asked, "How many ducats did you say?" 1,107, sir. Then he said, as if he were talking to himself, "It is very singular, yes, very strange, a curious coincidence." And then he began to ask questions and went over the whole ground from the beginning. "That settles it," he said. "I know the thief now. Lads, the money was stolen." Then he went away, leaving us troubled, wondering what he could mean. In about an hour, we found out. For by that time it was all over the village that Father Peter had been arrested for stealing a great sum of money from the astrologer. Everybody's tongue was loose and going. Many said it was not in Father Peter's character and must be a mistake, but the others shook their heads, saying that misery and want could drive a suffering man to almost anything. About one detail there was no differences. All agreed that Father Peter's account of how the money came into his hands was just about unbelievable. It had such an impossible look. Our characters began to suffer next. We were Father Peter's only witnesses. How much did he probably pay us to back up his fantastic tale? People talked that kind of talk to us pretty freely and frankly, and were full of scoffings when we begged them to believe we had told only the truth. Our parents were even harder on us than anyone. Our father said we were disgracing our families, and they commanded us to purge ourselves of our lie. There was no limit to their anger when we continued to say we had spoken true. Our mothers cried over us and begged us to give back our bribe and get back our honest names and save our families from shame. At last, we were so worried and harassed that we tried to tell the whole thing, Satan and all, but no, it wouldn't come out. We were hoping and longing all the time that Satan would come and help us out, but there was no sign of him. Within an hour after the astrologer's talk with us, Father Peter was in prison, and the money sealed up in the hands of the officers of the law. The money was in a bag, and Solomon Isaacs said he had not touched it since he had counted it. His oath was taken that it was the same money, and that the amount was 1,107 ducats. Father Peter claimed trial by the ecclesiastical court, but our other priest, Father Adolf, said an ecclesiastical court hadn't jurisdiction over a suspended priest. The bishop upheld him. That settled it. The case would go to trial in the civil court. The court would not sit for some time to come. William Meidling would be Father Peter's lawyer and do the best he could, of course, but he told us privately that a weak case on his side and all the power and prejudice on the other made the outlook bad. So Margaret's new happiness died a quick death. No friends came to console her, and none were expected. An unsigned note withdrew her invitation to the party. There would be no scholars to take lessons. How could she support herself? She could remain in the house, for the mortgage was paid off, even though the government, and not poor Solomon Isaacs, had the mortgage money in his grip for the present. Old Ursula, who was the cook, chambermaid, housekeeper, laundress, and everything else for Father Peter, said God would provide. But she said that from habit, for she was a good Christian. We boys wanted to go and see Margaret and show friendliness for her, but our parents were afraid of offending the community and wouldn't let us. The astrologer was going around inflaming everybody against Father Peter, saying he was an abandoned thief who had stolen from him. He said he knew he was a thief from the fact that it was exactly the sum he had lost, which Father Peter pretended he had found. In the afternoon of the fourth day after the catastrophe, old Ursula appeared at our house and asked for some washing to do. Margaret had not enough to eat and was growing weak. Ursula was growing weak herself and showed it, and she ate the food that was offered to her like a starving person, but could not be persuaded to carry any home for Margaret, who would not eat charity food. She took some clothes down to the stream to wash them, but when we saw from the window that handling the bat was too much for her strength, she was called back and offered a trifle of money. She said to protect Margaret's pride, she would explain that she had found it in the road, and to keep it from being a lie and damning her soul, she got me to drop it while she watched, and then she came along, picked it up, and went her way. Like the rest of the village, she could tell everyday lies fast enough and without taking any precautions against the fire and brimstone on their account. But this was a new kind of lie, and it had a dangerous look, because she hadn't any practice at it. After a week's practice, it wouldn't have given her any trouble. I was troubled. How could Margaret live? Ursula could not find a coin in the road every day, and I was ashamed, too, for not being near Margaret, so in need of friends. But that was my parents' fault, not mine. I couldn't help it. I was walking along the path, feeling very downhearted, when a most cheery and tingling sensation went rippling through me. I knew by that sign that Satan was nearby. Next moment, he was alongside of me, and I was telling him all my trouble and what had been happening to Margaret and her uncle. While we were talking, we turned a curve and saw old Ursula resting in the shade of a tree, and she had a lean, stray kitten in her lap and was petting it. I asked her where she got it, and she said it came out of the woods and followed her, and probably had no mother or friends, and she was going to take it home and care for it. Satan said to her, "I understand you're very poor. Why do you want to add another mouth to feed? Why don't you give it to some rich person?" Ursula bristled at this and said, "Perhaps you would like to have it. You must be rich, with your fine clothes and quality airs." Then she sniffed and said, "Give it to the rich. The idea. The rich don't care for anybody but themselves. It's only the poor that have feeling for the poor and help them. The poor and God. God will provide for this kitten." "What makes you think so?" said Satan. Ursula's eyes snapped with anger. "Because I know it," she said. "Not a sparrow falls to the ground without his seeing it." Satan replied, "But it falls, just the same. What good is seeing it fall?" Old Ursula's jaws worked, but could get no words out for the moment. She was so horrified. When she got her tongue, she stormed out. "Go about your business, or I'll take a stick to you." I could not speak. I was so scared. I knew that with his notions about the human race, Satan would consider it a matter of no consequence to strike her dead, there being plenty more. But my tongue stood still. I could give her no warning. But nothing happened. Satan remained tranquil and indifferent. I suppose he could not be insulted by Ursula any more than the king could be insulted by a ladybug. The old woman jumped to her feet when she made the remark. It had been many years since she moved that fast. That was Satan's influence. He was a fresh breeze to the weak and the sick. His presence affected even the lean kitten, and it skipped to the ground and began to chase a leaf. This surprised Ursula, and she stood looking at the creature, nodding her head in wonder, her anger quite forgotten. "What's come over it?" she said. "A while ago, it could hardly walk." "You've not seen a kitten of that breed before," said Satan. Ursula was not proposing to be friendly with a mocking stranger. She gave him an ungentle look and retorted, "Who asked you to come here and pester me? I'd like to know. What do you know about what I've seen and haven't seen?" Satan replied, "You haven't seen a kitten with the hair spines on its tongue pointing to the front, have you?" "No, nor you either." "Well, examine this one and see." Ursula was become pretty spry, but the kitten was spryer. She couldn't catch it and had to give up. And then Satan said, "Give it a name, and maybe it will come." Ursula tried several names, but the kitten was not interested. "Call it Agnes. Try that." The creature answered to the name and came. Ursula examined its tongue. "Upon my word, it's true," she said. "I have not seen this kind of cat before. Is it yours?" "No," replied Satan. "Then how did you know its name?" "All cats of that breed are named Agnes. They will answer to no other name." Ursula was impressed. "It is the most wonderful thing." Then a shadow of trouble came into her face, for her superstitions were aroused, and she reluctantly put the creature down, saying, "I suppose I must let it go. I'm not afraid, no. Not exactly, though the priests, well, I've heard people, and Besides, it's well now and can take care of itself. She sighed and turned to go, murmuring, "Such a pretty one, too, and would be such company. The house is so sad and lonesome these troubled days. The old master in jail." "It seems a pity not to keep it," said Satan. Ursula turned quickly, just as if she were hoping someone would encourage her. "Why?" she asked wistfully. "Because this breed brings luck."
"Does it? Is it true? Young man, do you know it to be true?"
"How does it bring luck?"
"Well, it brings money anyway," said Satan.
Ursula looked disappointed. "Money? A cat bring money? The idea! You could never sell it here. People do not buy cats here. One can't even give them away." She turned to go.
"I didn't mean sell it. This kind is called the lucky cat. Its owner finds 4 silver groschen in his pocket every morning."
I saw the indignation rising in the woman's face. She was insulted. This boy was making fun of her. She thrust her hands into her pockets and straightened up to give him a piece of her mind. Her temper was all up and hot. Her mouth came open and let out 3 words of a bitter sentence. Then it fell silent, and the anger in her face turned to surprise or wonder or fear or something, and she slowly brought out her hands from her pockets and opened them and held them. In one lay 4 silver groschen. She gazed a little while, perhaps to see if the groschen would vanish away, and then she said fervently, "It's true! It's true, and I'm ashamed. I beg forgiveness. Oh, dear master and benefactor," and she ran to Satan and kissed his hand over and over, according to the Austrian custom. In her heart, she probably believed it was a witch cat and an agent of the devil, but no matter. It was all the more certain to be able to keep its contract and furnish a daily good living for the family, for in matters of finance, even the most pious of our peasants would have more confidence in an arrangement with the devil than with an angel. Ursula started homeward, Agnes in her arms. I said to Satan, "I wish I had her privilege of seeing Margaret." Then I caught my breath, for there we were. There in the parlor, and Margaret standing looking at us, astonished. She was feeble and pale, and I knew that would change in Satan's glow, and so it did. I introduced Satan, that is, Philip Traum, and we sat down and talked. There was no constraint. We were simple folk in our village, and when a stranger was a pleasant person, we were soon friends. Margaret wondered how we got in without her hearing us. Tromp said the door was open, and we walked in and waited until she turned around to greet us. This was not true. No door was open. But no matter. What Satan wished a person to believe, that person was sure to believe. So Margaret was quite satisfied with the explanation. By then, her mind was on Tromp anyway. She couldn't keep her eyes off him. He was so beautiful. I hoped he would show off some, but he didn't. He seemed only interested in being friendly and telling lies. He said he was an orphan, and that made Margaret pity him. The water came into her eyes. He said he had never known his mama. She passed away when he was a young thing, and said his papa was in shattered health and had no property of any earthly value. But he had an uncle down in the tropics who was very well off, from whom he drew his support. The very mention of a kind uncle was enough to remind Margaret of her own, and her eyes filled again. But Margaret soon forgot her sorrow. She liked Philip, and I knew she would. And when he told her he was studying for the ministry, I could see that she liked him even more. And then, when he promised to get her admitted to the jail so that she could see her uncle, that was the capstone. He said he would give the guards a little present, and she must always go in the evening after dark and say nothing, but just show this paper and pass in, and show it again when you come out. And he scribbled some queer marks on the paper and gave it to her. She was ever so thankful, and right away in a fever for the sun to go down. For in that old, cruel time, prisoners were not allowed to see their friends, and sometimes they spent years in the jails without seeing a friendly face. I judged that the marks on the paper were an enchantment, and that the guards would not know what they were doing, nor have any memory of it afterwards. And that was indeed the way of it.
You've been listening to a radio adaptation of Mark Twain's The Mysterious Stranger.
Read and produced by Scooter. Tune in next week for more. And in the meantime, you can contact us at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks again for listening.
like an ocean.